The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
Where is the home place?
The home place as a building is a composite of several places in my memory and in my family, but its physical location in this story is east of Hardin, out a place called Sarpy Creek Road, where my grandmother's family actually did ranch, and I still have cousins.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Carrie LeSueur about her novel, The Home Place. You named the main character of this novel after your great-grandmother, whose name was Alma. Why was that important to you?
Alma really carried the family's heritage. She was born Alma Fly to a family that had homesteaded in the Gallatin Valley in 1864 and was married to a Bighorn County sheriff who later became a U.S. Marshal and lived really the arc of the 20th century in Montana. She knew the pioneers, and then she rode the centennial train in 1989 across the state with the sons and daughters of Montana pioneers and told us the old stories and made us understand that that heritage was something to be proud of.
In the novel, Alma is a corporate attorney who lives in present-day Seattle, and she travels to Billings to deal with the aftermath of the death of her younger sister, Vicky, who's died very suddenly. Explain what happened to Vicky and why Alma feels remorseful.
Vicky's life has really been a shadow of Alma's. They lost their parents when Alma was 17, Vicky was 12. Vicky lost her lower leg in that same accident and has lived with a prosthetic ever since. And very soon after the accident, Alma took off. She went away to college, and although they maintained contact for many years, Alma gradually weaned herself off that connection and finally cut Vicky off, not hard, but with letting her know that her life was too busy. And so much has gone wrong for Vicky. Alma feels as if this is the flip side of the coin of her life. This is what she had to abandon and leave behind to be successful herself.
Vicky died on a very, very cold night, and her 11-year-old daughter saw her leave their house without a coat, and she called some of the family members for help. Why didn't they come?
Well, this is part of the family story that develops over the course of the mystery that Alma is trying to solve in the home place. And it may be the real story of the novel, this family that is close enough to have stayed in contact and is tied together by a physical place that's very important to them all, but has really lost the ability to be there for each other. They've, even living in the same place, they've in some ways abandoned each other and given up on that sense of family that protects and nurtures. And Alma and Vicky have an older brother, Pete, who has struggled with alcoholism and is now dry and sober day by day. But there's a sense that may be a little fragile still. And Pete tells Alma, Vicky used Brittany to get help from people who were tired of helping her and tired of her games. And so he'd get a call from his niece saying there was no food in the house and they were hungry. And so, of course, he came. Of course, he showed up. And Vicky would be sitting on the couch watching soap operas, and he felt like the sucker delivery service.
Alma also found out that many of the coworkers at the place that she worked had been victims of Vicky's manipulation.
Vicky had worn out her welcome in a lot of places and pushed people to the edge of what they were willing to do for her without her being willing or maybe able to pay them back in any way. She was going through all of the resources she had and using them up one by one.
So let's hear a little bit of the book. This is a scene when Alma has arrived in Billings and she has to go to the morgue to identify Vicky's body.
The room he lets her into is nothing but a small antechamber to an office with an autopsy room beyond. Alma tries not to look through to the steel examination table and the instruments arrayed beside the sinks and along the walls, but they draw her eyes. It's impossible not to feel like a voyeur. She wants to look everywhere at once, to stare. Larry seems not to notice. He offers Alma a low plastic chair, then unlocks the heavy steel door that guards the cooler. As he swings open the door, a smell drifts out. Like Alma's high school biology classroom on the day they dissected frogs. Not strong, but evocative. She threw up in one of the lab sinks that day. Now she sits still and is thankful for the chair. Larry rolls out a steel gurney with a thick black pad. On top lies a heavy blue bag. He locks the gurney wheels, stands next to the head, and gestures for Alma to stand opposite him. I'll unzip the shroud enough to see her face, and all you have to do is nod yes or no, he says. He waits until Alma is in position, looks her over to be sure she's steady, then opens the shroud. Vicky's face is clean. Someone has wiped away the rest of the blood that still crusts at the edge of her mouth and combed her long, dark hair. Her features are a little puffy, bruised by postmortem lividity, but it's definitely her. All the Hopkins and Terrebonne genes pooled in her high cheekbones and long nose, so like Alma's that sometimes they could pass as each other with strangers when they were younger, even though Alma is 5 years older. The resemblance is strongest beside a campfire, when the low light draws out their bone structure. This is Alma's face, herself, the but-for-the-grace-of-God scenario. She mouthed the words, "There but for the grace of God go I." She has repeated them to herself many times as a talisman against hubris, and always when she says them, she thinks of Vicky, that other self, living out the bitter, addictive abandon that is the flip side of Alma's compulsive work ethic and white-knuckled self-control.
In retrospect, what does Alma think she could have done to help Vicky?
I think Alma is asking herself that question all the time, and that's at the root of a lot of her interactions with family members back in Montana. She says to Pete, what did you expect of me? What could I possibly have done? And at the time, there was probably very little, but there's been the intervening 15 years, and Alma has become financially stable and developed a career and a life of her own, and things have continued to fall apart for Vicky. So somewhere along that road, Alma gained a real upper hand and became somebody who might have been able to change the course of events. And I think it's that knowledge that's really seized her and is torturing her as she spends time back in Montana.
Like maybe if she had just stopped working and taken some kind of time off and come back for a week or two to talk with her sister and just be with her, that might have made a difference?
Maybe. We hear that Alma has had vacation time with Brittany. She's brought her out and taken her on trips. And Vicky has come to resent that. She feels as if Alma is trying to steal her daughter or take her place as the preferred parent, the aunt who has resources and can let Brittany do things that Vicky can't. So it's not even clear if Alma had tried harder and been more present that Vicky would have allowed her to help after a certain point. But there's, of course, the idea in Alma's mind that she should have done something, that this should not have been the outcome.
Hmm. In an online Q&A, you responded to a question about your hometown of Billings by saying, "I've got a century's worth of bad, crazy dirt on this place. That's why I write fiction." Is that bad, crazy dirt what you used to create Vicky's backstory, what you were thinking of there?
Well, I'm asked very frequently if this novel is autobiographical, and it's not. And the characters are composites. And I've had a lot of cousins show up to readings so far and ask me very explicit questions about who I'm talking about and where these places are and trying to make the connection between the bits and pieces that I've pulled together and the real places and people that they know. Because it's not, there is no one-to-one representation, but certainly these are places and types and storylines that are very familiar to me. And I've composed them into a fiction.
Montana's Crow Indian tribe makes a few appearances in the novel, and I'd like you to read a passage in which Alma goes to City Hall to talk with a Billings police detective. She's got her niece Brittany and her grandmother Maddie with her.
Alma herds Brittany and Maddie across two intersections and up to the glassed-in front desk at City Hall, where a short-haired woman in a snug pink polo shirt calls Detective Curtis to meet them. When the heavy metal door to the offices swings open, Alma realizes that she knows him. "Ray, hello," she offers her hand. "You look familiar. Remember me from school?" Ray is only slightly taller than Alma, but solidly built under his well-pressed detective's business casual. She is surprised to see his hair braided down his back. The police dress code must have relaxed, and Ray himself has changed from the skinny, buzz-cut kid she knew. Everything else about him is perfectly regulation, down to his well-groomed fingernails and shiny boots. His dark eyes are guarded, but he smiles readily enough when he recognizes her. "I was a few years ahead of you at senior." He takes her hand and gives it the gentle press with which Indians interpret this foreign gesture. "How interesting." He will have shaken enough white hands to understand the cultural expectation of a firm handshake, and he is either rejecting that altogether or making some sort of exception for her, either personally or because of her gender. "Were you rotsy, very clean-cut?" He ducks his head with a little acknowledging smile. "Coming off the res, that's pretty much the only way to get through college. I did criminal justice here at MSUB. Your family must be proud." At the mention of family, Alma remembers her own. She steps to the side to show Brittany and Maddie to Ray. "My family, yeah." Ray laughs like she's cracked an inside joke. "They call me Apple." Apple, Alma knows that one. Red on the outside, white on the inside. Red, white, it doesn't matter. This is what the place does to anyone with talent and ambition. It slaps them down and mocks them until they get out or give up. Ray will be heading one way or the other himself by now. She looks at him more carefully. There's something else she knows about him, a thing she can never say. Ray is Mountain Crow. His ancestors roamed the high country of what are now the Bighorns and Absaroka Beartooth Range. When they were driven out by the whittling of the reservation, removed from the place now called Absaroka after the people forced to abandon it, there were white settlers waiting to move in, and Alma's ancestors were among them. Alma has the homestead patent in her files. The story has come down to her through journals written in a tight cursive with careful line drawings. These are things that are never said among white and crow in this town. This is the history lying under thin, angry skins, separating people who ought to be united by a common love of fried food and ritualistic spectacle, fairs, powwows, and rodeos, the deliberate enactment of culture, the heartbeat of ceremony.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Carrie LeSueur about her novel, The Home Place. When we come back, we'll find out why Carrie LeSueur became an attorney and why her great-grandmother couldn't use the college scholarship she earned. If you'd like to hear this program again or share it with a friend, you'll find audio online at mtpr.org/twq. There's also a link to it on our Facebook page. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Thank you. addition to the research you did about the logistics of criminal investigations and so on, you also went through a process of allowing your characters, this is something that you've said, you allowed your characters to work out things that you needed to know through the process of writing. Can you talk more about that?
The story that Alma is living and coming back to Montana has a lot of interest for me as a person who left and has deep roots and spent many years figuring out if I could come back and why I felt a need to come back. And so in writing this story, I needed to set events in motion that would bring Alma back and bring people into her life that she would have to deal with, people who knew secrets about her and her deep history and would not let her gloss over the surface as she likes to do. And so although there is a fairly tightly plotted mystery that carries the story forward, the interest of it for me was largely in watching Alma and then some of her friends and relations deal with her return. And that's a large part of the narrative, and I hope why people will engage with these characters rather than just the events moving them along.
What did you discover during that process about your own sense of a home place?
Well, there's a very common longing in this country where we're so nomadic for a place where we have true roots and feel that we are home for good or evil in a lot of cases. It's not a universally positive thing to have those deep ties. And I had to decide for myself how important that was to me and how important it was to me to raise my children here. And I wrote this book over most of a decade as I was getting myself to a place where I could come back to Montana, where I'd have professional opportunities and my husband would be able to find work as an academic. And this writing project helped me, I think, center myself around the knowledge that this place has some fundamental importance for me, and the heritage is something I really deeply want to hand down to my children.
Like the stories that your great-grandmother told?
Like my great-grandmother's stories. And there are a lot of storytellers in my family and certainly among my friends. So a lot of those stories make their way into the home place. Most of the historic stories in the book have some sort of background in family stories. I stole those pretty liberally, and my cousins are aware of it, that nobody's objected so far.
You, like Alma, are an attorney, and yet it doesn't seem like you set out to be an attorney. How did that happen?
Well, I have always been very interested in law as an academic field, and I have way too much education, and I got to a point where I was using a graduate degree in modern languages and doing some teaching, and really felt dissatisfied with it. Just didn't think that academia was going to be a good fit for me. And I tried doing some writing at that point. I spent a summer at the Iowa Writers' Workshop and really didn't feel as if I belonged in the workshopping world either. It was just not feeding the kind of joy I get out of writing. It was a harsh experience rather than something that nurtured me. And I made the decision to go to law school for a couple of reasons, because I wanted to have the tools to work on behalf of people I know, people I come from, who are struggling with mineral development and handling the legal needs in farm and ranch country that get more and more urgent as land is passed down from generation to generation. And so that's something I've gotten to do. I founded a nonprofit that provides legal work for communities and nonprofits dealing with natural resource issues. And that's been incredibly satisfying to me. I founded Plains Justice in 2006, living in Iowa, where my husband comes from, in response to proposals for a couple of very large coal plants that were going up in Iowa. I was working for a private firm at the time, and I was one of the few attorneys in the area who had this sort of expertise around Clean Air Act permitting and the other environmental permitting. And I was very eager to respond. I was getting calls from private citizens, people living near the proposed plants who were very worried about what would happen to their communities. And after a lot of exploration, talking to a lot of people who worked in this area, I found that the only way to respond was to found a new nonprofit. And so it was a response to a need rather than something I spontaneously decided I had to go out and do. But that led to so much wonderful work. We've worked right across the Great Plains states, done a lot in the Dakotas, represented farmers and ranchers, and worked with tribes in the siting process for the Keystone One and the Keystone XL pipeline, and a lot of studies and education about what the impacts of those projects might be, and produced white papers and reports on energy issues, educated rural electric co-ops about their clean energy options, which can be really hard for a small utility to engage in. So the nonprofit is alive and well. I'm now on the board, and I've gone back to private practice. And we're getting on our feet again after the contraction in foundation funding, after the financial fallout in 08 and 09. But this has been really just a journey of love and a response to really clearly expressed need, people calling up and saying, can you help us somehow? And that continues to this day. We get calls in our private practice that I refer over to the nonprofit, and we try to find a way to respond to communities' legal needs. There's often just not a lawyer out there who has both the expertise and the ability to put in hours on pro bono work involving environmental and natural resource issues. So we keep doing that, and it's good work. Another reason I went to law school is because it would be a profession I could practice pretty much wherever I wanted to be. And that was one thing that I felt that I needed to have. I needed to know that I could support myself. And I would always keep writing. It's never been a question of whether I would write or not. It's a compulsion. But this way, I could do work I cared about, bring myself home to Montana, and give myself a space to do other work I wanted to do, like gradually produce a novel.
I was really curious about one of your ideas. It's what you describe as the subterranean currents of creativity, and your quest to find out if they flow in rural Montana in the same ways that they flow in creative centers, say, on the East and West Coast. What did you find out about that?
Well, there's such visible and vivid creativity in places where artists and writers and musicians gather, and it's so rich and wonderful to be part of communities like that. And yet, I know of people and have dear friends who manage to create wonderful work very far distant from those centers of creativity. And I didn't know coming back here. It had been so many years, and I wasn't sure what kind of effect being back home would have on my writing. And it's been, for me, just tapping into a spring. And the French word, I speak French, I've studied a lot of languages, and the French word for spring is a source. And that's what I've found, that being close to the stories and to people who are not in the least inhibited in their creativity because of their location, who find it an inspiration, that's made me much more able to write and just has let flow all kinds of stories that I can't wait to tell.
Alma has managed to escape what she's seen as kind of a mundane, lower middle class existence, and she's gone out and become a corporate attorney working in Seattle. She's the only one in her family who, as she puts it, got out. Why did she feel such a strong urge to leave?
The way I wrote Alma, I think, goes back to a lot of family history and people feeling as if they were denied opportunities and trying to make those opportunities possible for the next generation. Only one of my grandparents graduated from high school. My mother was the first college graduate in her family. She graduated from MSU Bozeman in, I think, 1960. My dad went to college on the GI Bill. It was tremendously important for them to make higher education possible for their children. And so there's that drive that I think is common in a lot of families with working class and agricultural roots to give the children at least the opportunity for something different, give them choices that the previous generation didn't have. But my grandma Jenny, who is one of the people I dedicated the book to, was really in my mind as I pictured Alma's fury to go and do something that was beyond what anybody expected of her. Jenny Kiefer graduated from Hardin High School in 1930. She was the valedictorian, and she won the scholarship that you did in those days to go to one of the state universities, and could not pay for room and board. Couldn't find anybody who'd let her work for room and board because she was a woman and it was the Depression and a man should have that scholarship. And she was a brilliant woman, worked all her life and was so passionate about education and opportunities for her children and grandchildren. And it's not just Alma here, it's the roots she comes from and the people she was brought up by and what they wanted for her.
Carrie LeSueur lives in Billings, Montana. You'll find more about her and her novel at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. You'll also find links to that information on our Facebook page. Thanks for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.